You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If you really want to know what people suggest, Shireen Elfecky, start by looking inside their bedrooms. And Ms. Elfecky has been doing just that during the past 5 years as she's traveled throughout the Middle East studying sexual practices and norms in an environment of popular revolt and increasing conservatism. Shireen Elfecky is the former vice chair of the UN's Global Commission on HIV and Law and an award-winning journalist, having reported for The Economist and Al Jazeera English. Her book, Sex and the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World, is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
And what led you to focus on this aspect of Arab culture?
Two aspects, really. One is my personal background, but also my professional background. So speaking personally, I am half Egyptian. Most of my family live in Egypt. I'm Muslim. But I grew up in Canada, and I never really thought about my Arab heritage until September 11th. And the tragic events of that day and the aftermath really prompted me to want to understand the Arab world, where I came from, what makes these people tick. The professional side is that my background is in immunology and HIV/AIDS, and I became interested in what was happening in HIV in the Arab world. And if you want to understand HIV there, you need to look at sex.
And Egypt is an obvious choice because your background is partly Egyptian. But how representative is Egypt of the Arab world?
Yeah, I focused on Egypt not just because of my personal connection, but because it is the most populous country in the Arab world. And it has tremendous soft power. Egyptian movies, Egyptian radio, Egyptian newspapers, television series. Egypt has a real influence on the region.
It used to be the center of the caliphate.
It comes and goes, comes and goes.
Well, how comprehensive are the data about sexual practices in Egypt? I can't imagine that you have people doing the equivalent of Kinsey reports.
Well, exactly. We don't have a Kinsey report for the Arab world. We don't have a height report for the Arab world. And that's one of the things I call for in my book. We need more robust data. What we really have are snapshots of sexual life, and they tend to be focused more around problems than more sort of positive, constructive aspects of sexuality.
And talking about problems, there have been numerous reports during ongoing protests in Egypt that female protesters have been given they have been molested and then given virginity tests. Has this been a common practice used by police over the years?
Yeah, sexual violence is an instrument of power everywhere in the world. And it's a particularly potent one in the Arab region because sex is very closely associated with shame. So if you want to cause maximum havoc in a society, you go after women sexually because you not only affect them, because a woman's honor is connected to the family's honor, you affect her menfolk as well.
But what is the police rationale for doing something like that?
I mean, there are a number of different dynamics of sexual violence going on in the Arab world at the moment. I mean, there is the drip, drip, drip of daily sexual harassment. More than 50% of young women in urban centers in Egypt experience sexual harassment. And then there is sexual violence in the home, domestic violence. And then we have these sort of spectacular examples of sexual assault, like on the protesters you mentioned in Tahrir Square, or the rapes that are going on in the Syrian civil war. Now, that's more to do with a grab for power. And as I've said, sexual violence is an incredibly potent tool for power.
I can't feel too superior because there are similar problems in this country, and we're not undergoing serious change at this moment. But what has this sort of thing discouraged women from protesting?
No, not at all. And in these tragic episodes of these sexual attacks, this is the one silver lining, if you like. Women are now emboldened to speak out. 10 years ago, you would not have a woman coming on television and saying, "I had been raped." There was such a sense of not just personal shame, but as I said, collective shame and an attack on the family honor. Now women are saying this openly, not all women, but some women, and also women are protesting. They are back in the square, and they are saying, "This is my right to protest."
Although in other parts of the Muslim world, women are being prosecuted for sex crimes after they've been raped, for being adulterers.
Absolutely. And we have this problem recently that came to light in Morocco of a young woman who committed suicide because she had been raped and her assailant had got off the hook by marrying her. So the laws around sexuality, and particularly women's sexuality, are you know, frankly unjust in many, many countries in the region, and there is much scope for reform in the years to come.
Samira Ibrahim, one of the victims of the virginity test in Tahrir Square, brought the military to court, but the doctor who performed the test was exonerated. Are there laws in place to protect against sexual violence in Egypt and against sexual harassment?
There are some laws. They're not specific for sexual harassment, for example. And there is a move now, there's a push from NGOs certainly to try and get better laws on the books. But I have to tell you that the law is not enough. If we look in countries like Tunisia or Algeria, which do have laws on sexual harassment still happens. Just because you change a law doesn't mean you change the mentality. In my opinion, as a liberal Muslim woman, a good law, a progressive law that protects women's rights is better than a bad law. But it's certainly not sufficient. More needs to be done to change attitudes and behaviors on the ground.
Do you think the popular revolutions across the Arab region have affected sexual practices or norms?
I think it's too early to tell. And there has been a lot of talk now that we've had a political revolution. Will there be a sexual revolution? But the reality is that we haven't really even had a political revolution. Sexual attitudes and behaviors are deeply ingrained, and they will take decades to change.
If anything, secular regimes, repressive ones to be sure, but secular regimes are being overthrown, and more religious regimes have replaced them, as we see in Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood is in power. Is that likely to lead to more conservative attitudes about sex?
Well, quite frankly, the secular regimes weren't all that great on women's rights and sexual rights anyway. If you look at a country like Tunisia, homosexuality was illegal, sex outside of marriage was illegal. This was under the Ben Ali regime. Just because Islamists have come to power, the attitudes are conservative in society. Changing them is going to, as I said, take more than just law. It will take time. But I think the key thing is that now people can discuss this openly, and they have a freedom of expression that they did not have under the old authoritarian regimes. And they are now challenging the Islamists and their ideas, and that's a positive step forward.
Well, you talked about laws against homosexuality. Male friends who've traveled to Cairo have told me about being frequently solicited by Egyptian men for sex. Is that part of a gay culture, or are sexual relationships between men more acceptable in this heterosexual society?
Homosociality, so close interaction between men, is common in the Arab world. So on the streets of Cairo, you will see two Egyptian men holding hands, something that if you saw in a man and a woman holding hands, it might be frowned upon.
But they will say that's not homosexual.
That's homosociality. That's not homosexuality per se. There is, of course, male sex work. Anywhere where there is poverty, and there is lots of that, lots of poverty in Egypt. And yes, I mean, men have sex with men. Some of them think of themselves as gay, some Egyptian men. Others have sex with men, and they wouldn't adopt a gay identity. It doesn't apply to them. The sexualities are still quite fluid in the Arab world.
My guest is Shireen El-Feki, F-E-K-I. Her book, Sex in the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World. Arab scholars have written about sexual practices in the West. What are their criticisms?
It depends on what period you're looking at. There is a famous Egyptian imam called Al-Tahtawi who came to the West in the 19th century and saw much to admire in Western culture and thought women had a little too much freedom. But the one thing, interestingly, that he did say when he looked at France is that he said, there's absolutely no tolerance of homosexuality whatsoever. If you fast forward,
which of course was not true,
absolutely, and also the same back in Egypt, he said, this is the one thing that Egyptians and the French have in common. But of course, that wasn't true. Homosexuality has a long history in Arab culture.
Some suggest that when Muslim women cover their bodies, it allows them to have more control over their sexuality. Do you see the hijab and abaya as serving feminist purposes?
Let's not talk about feminist purposes. Let's talk about individual women. Over 90% of young women in Egypt wear hijab, not necessarily abaya. You find that more in the Gulf. Many women I know wear it because they want to express their religious identity, and this is the way that they pay tribute to their faith. Other women wear it because it actually cuts them some slack. You can put on a hijab, and yet you can be wearing tight jeans and a very tight tunic and lots of makeup, and yet your parents will let you out of the house because you have on the hijab. So it actually gives them freedom.
I've spoken to a number of women who, from Iran, for example, filmmakers and such, who didn't wear the headscarf here but wore it when they were presenting their films because they would be seen there, which said to me that if you're given the choice, you wouldn't be wearing the headscarf.
I don't think you can generalize in that way. I know many women in my own family, for example. Some of the women wear hijab and some of the women do not. But my family is in a position where we can make that choice. And I think that's the key thing. If women want to wear the hijab and they make an informed decision about that, then we should respect their choice. The problem is that very many women in the Arab world don't have that freedom.
There is a long tradition of erotic literature in Muslim culture. But what's happened? Is there a standard interpretation of how the Quran regulates sexual practices?
You're right about the long history of erotica in Arabic.
1001 Nights has some stories that have been censored in the West.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, quite frankly, Cosmopolitan, Playboy, The Joy of Sex have nothing on some of these books which appeared in the 9th or 10th centuries. And indeed, the Prophet Muhammad himself spoke extensively and in tremendous, highly humane detail about sexual life. It's interesting that sort of ease with sex that is reflected in literature has largely been lost today, and that the only time, as I mentioned earlier, that you can really talk about sex in public life is really when it's a catastrophe or a scandal or a crisis. And that wasn't always the way.
So what happened? Did Western colonialization have an impact on sexual practices?
Is it
a reaction to the West?
It's interesting. It's a very complex historical process, and a number of historians have examined this. And the hypothesis, and I think it holds, it has tremendous validity, is that if you look at this writing, it tends to shut down around the 19th century. And it's not a surprise that coincides with European occupation of many countries in the Arab world. And it gains ground, particularly in the post-Second World War period and with the rise of Islamic conservatism. And one could argue that the rise of Islamic conservatism in a place like Egypt, for example, has been in the last 50 years a response to dictatorship, and that thinking has closed down on everything, on politics, on economics, on culture, and sex is just one of those elements of closure.
But there was a time when the Muslim world was the center of learning, and Europe was backward.
And at that time, they wrote and spoke about sex very freely.
So this is going back 500 years.
More than that, 1,000 years. That
the height. No, I mean 500 years where things started changing. No.
So, well, I mean, the real, as I said, as reflected in the literature, and you must remember, this literature is not some sort of medieval Masters and Johnson, right? This is not necessarily a direct reflection of sexual life, but it is a reflection of sexual attitudes. And that started shutting down, as I said, in the 19th century, so over the last 150 years.
Have marriage practices changed along with sexual practices?
So marriage practices in terms of...
Well, first of all, you looked at Egypt and you also looked at the Gulf states, which are very different kinds of cultures, aren't they?
There's tremendous diversity.
Is polygamy something that's common in Egypt?
Polygamy is very expensive. And so most men will tell you they can barely afford to have one wife. What has happened, though, certainly with the growing costs of marriage and the inability of young people to be able to afford marriage, forms of sort of so-called informal marriages, like what's called Orfi marriage, which are not registered by the state, but have a sort of Islamic cover, many young people are turning to these because they can't afford to get married. The citadel of which I speak in the book is this idea that the only socially acceptable context for sex is marriage. So if you can't get to that, you're going to try, or at least many young people do, to give yourself some sort of marriage context. And so, yes, there are these informal marriages.
Marriages that aren't for forever? Muta marriages?
Muta is a Shia construct, and that's very open in its intentions. It's about having a sexual relationship. Although it's permitted in Shia Islam, it's also not considered to be socially acceptable by many scholars, for example. And so the point I make in the book is that often we use Islam as an excuse to say that something is wrong. But if we dig into Islam, we see that there are multiple interpretations. And really, Islam is being used as an excuse for other objections, like social objections or political objections.
And you may make the point that distinctions are made between the Shia and the Sunni. Is there any consistency between the two groups?
There are on a number of issues related to sexuality, but also Shia Muslims have quite a different perspective on issues. For example, sex change operations are permitted in Shia Islam. In fact, there was a fatwa from the Ayatollah Khomeini, I think, that permitted this, whereas it's considered to be highly controversial in Sunni Islam.
How are unmarried mothers treated?
Well, as I said, the citadel is sex within marriage. So if you're not supposed to be having sex outside of marriage, you're definitely not supposed to be having kids outside of marriage.
Well, you describe virgin births in your book.
Yeah, this is the story of Faiza, a young woman I met in Morocco. She told me the story of the conception of her child, and when she went to seek help because she had to leave her family, she was concerned about being assaulted by the male members of her family because she had impugned the family honor, and she was almost raped when she went for help. And in telling me this story, she also wanted to point out to me that she was a virgin, because she had become pregnant through sort of superficial sexual contact. Now, this Faiza is a high school student. She graduated. So you can imagine the levels of sexual ignorance. There's no sexuality education for young people in most of the Arab world. She knew so little. And so that's why she became pregnant through unprotected superficial sex.
What is super? I'm sorry, maybe I shouldn't ask that on daytime radio.
Her partner.
I've had superficial relationships in my time, but that's something totally different.
Yes, I suspect not quite as much risk of pregnancy, but because of the emphasis on virginity, and virginity defined as an intact hymen, often they will not have vaginal sex. There will be other practices. I think the important point about Faiza in her terrible story is that there is actually a silver lining to that, in that there are NGOs in Morocco which are trying to help young women so that they don't have to hand off their kids to orphanages. They can actually live with them in society, find jobs, find places to live. I can tell you that as a single woman, when I started this book, I was engaged, and I found it hard to get an apartment. So you can imagine a single mother. But these groups...
They didn't want to rent to you because you're a woman?
Because I'm a single woman. And in many parts of the Arab world, if you're not married, you can't move out of the home. And if you are moving out of the home, there must be something wrong with you.
On the other hand, you found a sex therapist in Cairo.
There are sex therapists everywhere in the Arab region, many of them on television, and interestingly, most of them women.
So what are they saying? I mean, are they giving good advice?
They're giving advice which I think helps people on the ground, because most of the advice that they give, the majority of these therapists on television, for example, are working within an Islamic framework. And that's how most people, in my experience, in the Arab world, want to lead their lives. They want to live within the borders of Islam.
And what happens on television and in the movies? How far do they go?
Historically, in the movies, for example, there's a long history of tackling sexual themes in the 60s and 70s. And I'm talking about Egypt in particular, because it's the center of movie making. More recently, there's been a trend towards what's called clean cinema, and this is coinciding with the rise of Islamic conservatism over the last sort of 30, 40 years, in which they try to get rid of sexual scenes. Now, that's in mainstream Egyptian cinema. There have been other groups, filmmakers who have pushed the boundaries and tackled very tough issues like sexual harassment, for example. And cinema elsewhere in the Arab region, Morocco, Lebanon, is actually tackling tough themes, including homosexuality. But the reality is that we still have state censorship across the Arab world. Even though we've had the Arab Spring and people feel more free to express themselves, the instruments in the structures of censorship still exist.
In Bollywood films, which are not Muslim films, they can get pretty hot, and at the same time, couples can kiss because the audience knew they weren't really married.
Sorry,
those in Hindu films.
Yes.
So this is not unique to Islam.
Absolutely. These conservative attitudes and the taboos I'm talking about in the book are not exclusively Arab. You see them across Asia. You have even seen them in Latin America. These are phenomena of the global South. And lest we forget, these attitudes were also present in the West before the sexual revolution.
Now, what about female circumcision, which upsets a lot of people in the West? That doesn't occur in Egypt, does it?
Of course it does. 90% of women who under age 50 have been circumcised.
And why is the practice used? It eliminates any possibility of a woman having sexual pleasure, doesn't it? Cutting off a clitoris?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So, and that's quite contentious. The reason they do it, multiple reasons, partially for tradition, partially because they think it looks nicer if that area is tidied up. Partially, people will argue that it's religiously mandated, but that's highly controversial, and many religious figures have said, no, Islam does not permit this. The reality is that many women see the clitoris as a sort of driver of sexual desire, and the concern is that if you don't tame the clitoris, it will mean that your daughters will try to have sex before marriage, and which is outside the citadel, it's considered haram in Islam, or they will make excessive demands of their husbands during marriage, both of which will be marriage killers.
What happens if it becomes known that a woman is not a virgin?
It's problematic. Virginity is a big deal, and it remains a big deal in the Arab world. And, for example, in Egypt, there are ways to demonstrate it. So on the wedding night, it is quite common that a sheet will be laid down under the bride, and in the process of defloration, she will bleed, and that sheet will be shown to the family and neighbors. And that's because virginity is not a question of an individual's state, bodily state. Virginity for women is a question of the family's honor, that the family and the men of the family have been able to deliver an intact bride.
Now, you spoke to a lot of people in researching this book. Were they open about what goes on in their lives?
They were wonderfully open. They were frank. They were funny. It was remarkable. Mainly women I spoke with because they felt more comfortable, but often men and young men and men who have sex with men were also very frank with me.
Mm-hmm. And did anything surprise you?
I was surprised at how much is going on to solve problems. There is the perception that the Arab world is mired in sort of sexual angst and malaise and nothing can be done, but that's so far from the truth.
Well, how aware are they of what's going on in the West? I've heard that in Saudi Arabia there's a lot of trafficking in Western pornography.
The internet and satellite TV in particular has opened the world, particularly to young people, so they are quite aware of what is going on. Obviously, the internet and satellite TV movies are not a 2020 vision on Western sexual life. Nonetheless, they have a view. And what's most interesting is that they know exactly what they like about Western sexual culture, and they know what they could do without.
Some people have suggested that the Arab world, or parts of the Arab world anyway, are at a point similar to where the West was in the early 60s, before the sexual revolution.
Absolutely. I mean, the taboos around sex outside of marriage, abortion, homosexuality, masturbation, and this culture of silence, yes, is very familiar. However, I think it's wrong to look at this point of departure and say that, the Arab world is going to head into a sexual revolution like the West.
Now, can you describe the image on the cover of your book, which uses the star and the crescent in a way that is rather provocative?
Yes, it's a star and the crescent, two of them positioned as breasts.
And have people been critical of this, people in the Muslim world?
I haven't really been engaged in that cover so much. I was involved in a different cover that was done for a Canadian edition, and that was a piece of calligraphy in the shape of a woman's body. But for that, we used the words for sex that come from the medieval period, because we used to have thousands of words to talk about sex in Arabic, and now we have very few. And so we used some of those lost words to create the body of a woman. And that cover, which has been seen by many of my friends in the Arab region, they think it's very beautiful and culturally relevant.
Mm, they might not like this one as much. This is the American, the U.S.
That
version.
Is the American cover, yes.
And it is, the book is called Sex and the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World, written by Shireen El-Fekky. F-E-K-I, who's a writer, broadcaster, academic, who started professional life in medical science before going on to become an award-winning journalist for The Economist and a presenter at Al Jazeera English. She's also the former vice chair of the UN's Global Commission on HIV and Law and a TED Global Fellow. The book is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.